This is Andy.
And this is Matt.
And you're listening to
The Hop Podcast with No Name.
What a dumb name.
It's so stupid. So we'll start with potentially the thrilling conclusion of our time with Eric and Ron. Potentially. Probably.
Potentially. We're not sure.
Maybe.
It depends upon.
Next episode, I guess, if it was.
If they're still here or not. So those of you who haven't been able to hear the whole story, it starts in episode 44. And we've had Eric and Ron with us. Eric is the former CEO of Era Energy. And Ron is the former EHS manager for the same company. And we are exploring and understanding their journey from not having a mindset that aligned with HOP concepts to the thought process change, to the nitty gritty details of how things were communicated, to what it started to look like in the field, like the changes that were occurring after some metric changes. And we've gone through quite a few aspects of the transformation that they've gone through already. And where we left off in this story, if I can try to wrap my head around at least the questions that I have remaining, we talked about the thought process that needed to shift, the metrics that changed to align with that thought process, the way it was communicated out to the larger masses of the organization, how the behavior then started to change in terms of operational leadership and what they were looking at, what they thought was important, where they wanted to put their time and resources. And the question that I was left with was, as folks are out in the field understanding barrier health, and you get a metric report back. Ron, you gave the example of, the exclusion zone around crane operations. When a leader hears through either their proactive metrics or something has gone wrong already in the field, and a portion of that is that people were not following the current guidelines for exclusion zone. Many organizations, in hearing that, the knee-jerk reaction is to go do the thing that, Ron, at least you and I, we've done a million times, which is, this is the rule. People weren't following the rule, and that's why there was a problem. And then we have sort of this scripted solution set for when a rule isn't being followed, or we find an audit finding that shows we have a non-compliance. And that scripted solution set is something like, you go, you retrain people, you tell them to do it better the next time, you put more eyes around auditing more often, and you write the person up or the people up that weren't following the rule to begin with. And that's sort of this nugget of a solution set that historically we've always seemed to follow. But last episode, you described this specific non-conformance with your current process. You described a very different response to it, right? When you got these audit findings back that showed that you had a deficiency in this barrier, instead of doing that, you went out into the field and you learned directly from the folks that were doing the work as to what it was like to actually use this type of exclusion zone, whether or not it was right-sized for the level of risk that people were actually assuming in doing the work, and ultimately ended up making a change in this circumstance to the rule itself, as opposed to doing all the rest of the stuff I just listed off. And the question that I had was, why? Like, where is that in the transformational journey that you had? Because none of the stuff that we said ahead of this seems to explain that change in behavior and that leadership change.
Can we take a crack at it?
Yeah. Sure, go for it, Ron. I'm okay. So curious. Okay. Yeah.
So I think, as we continue to expose ourselves to the five principles, and as we begin to embrace that, humans are imperfect and we make mistakes, and as we learn how context influences behavior, and we embrace the fact that our systems are designed perfectly to deliver the results that we are getting, we then begin to take a different look at how we solve that problem. Mm-hmm. That workers come to work to do good work. And that's now the belief system. And trying to understand what about our process is making that difficult, and what can we do to make it easier, better, more valuable to them is the curiosity that we have. And the mission that we now have in front of us is to try to understand how, I mean, ultimately, they are the ones we're serving. And so trying to understand how our programs, our processes, how our systems are influencing their decisions and actions is ultimately where our curiosity should be centered. And that's ultimately the shift in how we're, you know, that's safety differently. That's the new view. That is ultimately what I think is human and organizational performance.
And Ron, why this is so interesting to me, and I'm curious where the messaging that you just said, like where that is echoed in the organization, right? Is that something that is also communicated in town halls? Is that something that just lived within the leadership team in the safety space? So when you guys were called upon, that's the way that you responded to it. The reason why it is so genuinely interesting and why I'm so curious about it is most organizations that we get to interface with have gotten one piece of the puzzle or the other, but not both. Meaning up until this point in how we've talked about your journey, we kind of highlighted one piece of the puzzle that some organizations get. And that's the shift in what we think is important to manage in safety, right? That is one piece of the puzzle. The how we then learn about it and manage it, meaning like the general concepts that people tend to know of what HOP is, of, hey, we need psychological safety, and the folks that are close to the work, they understand the context, and that context drives behavior, and learning and improving is vital, and leadership response matters, and how we ask questions matters, and the way we're asking questions, and things are not just cut and dry, and there's a black line and there's a blue line, all of the things that people would kind of roll up into this ball of what HOP is, what learning teams are, what operational learning is. Some organizations get that piece, but it's very rare that we're finding an organization gets both, meaning they're either going out and measuring barrier health, but when they find a deficiency, they're going back to sort of safety one-ish views of how to manage it, or they're going out and they're operationally learning, but there isn't really a focus as to what to do with the information, right? The focus can still be very, very much on a totally preventive mindset and not very much in the idea of, hey, what's over on the right-hand side of the bow tie is incredibly important for us to be spending our time and our resources on. How did you manage both? Where did that second puzzle piece come from?
So we had a good example to go by, first of all, because we had been sitting in accident investigation review sessions with Eric, who was asking, you know, with a lot of curiosity about how our systems and are influencing people's decisions and behavior. So we had a view of what that could look like for us. So that's one piece. The second piece is, you know, we had intentionally, you know, introduced the five principles in a very meaningful way in workshops to the senior leadership group, who then cascade that kind of curiosity throughout the with their direct reports, started seeing things differently as well. And then as part of our integration plan, we wanted to build fluency within the organization. So that next level leadership group were also exposed through human and organizational performance workshops. So they got to feel what that looked like and how that was different from the way that they viewed management of safety and many other aspects of performance outside of environmental health and safety. And I think that through those interactions, through those engagements, I think there was just a general tipping point within the organization, you know, that we encountered where, you know, instead of having a stand down and retraining everyone on the expectations, we began to understand that, you know, the process could be a big part of the problem and some adjustment could be necessary, and being humble enough to admit to that, and going to those workers who are in it every day and making it successful most of the time and getting their feedback. And what we learned is that they in fact do have information that we don't, and they often have a much, from a business perspective, a strategic answer to the problems that we're facing. They know what will help them and they know what isn't helping them. And having a structure that allows for that, having a culture that supports, you know, taking the time to pull those folks into the conversation, I think is kind of the milestone that that was the point in which we felt like we were really had started to move the needle.
Because now you had an overall metric direction, meaning your lagging metric was looking at whether or not those barriers were healthy and working at the time that an event occurred. And then you had a proactive metric, a leading metric in which you were looking at barrier health when there wasn't an event happening. And then the thing that I find incredibly important is there was also a direction of what to do with that information, right? So when we find that we have some sort of deficiency, you all had spent the time and energy to create the skill set that was one of those elements of the transformation, right? The skill set of what to do in order to allow yourselves to improve that deficiency, that it wasn't the same playbook that you had used historically. I'm sure it was in some circumstances, right? But not all the time pulling from the same playbook. But the playbook itself on how to manage the deficiency involved some level of operational learning, some level of going to the end user to understand their context, to understand the real problems as to why that barrier wasn't as strong as we had hoped, and making tangible changes to something in order to improve that strength. And the part that I'm curious about, maybe Eric, you can sort of shed some light on this piece for us. We talked last episode about the decluttering of administrative requirements is sort of being a natural byproduct of the direction that you helped the organization start to move in. Was it also, was this curiosity about the health of the barrier and then gaining information directly from those that were doing the work, was that also a natural byproduct of the change in direction, or was that something that intentionally had to be created to work in tandem with your change of direction?
Yeah, I mean, it's so we haven't talked a lot about the results of this effort yet, but let me just put a couple of them out there. So what we saw over the period we did this, we started this focus, we saw a 60% reduction in the number of PCIF incidents where we failed lucky, where luck was the only reason why it didn't escalate. 60% reduction. That was hugely satisfying. But with that, we were also watching, and our operations leaders were watching, and our safety leaders were watching, the leading indicator, which was about those field visits, those field audits, if you want to call it that. And we saw the same amount of reduction. We saw the two lines trending together, the leading and the lagging, which gave us some confidence that we were focusing on the right things. Yeah?
Meaning, let me just make sure I understand that correctly. So meaning when folks went out to the field to look at whether or not a critical barrier was in place, working, looked the way that we had imagined it to look, they found increasingly that that was true. at the same time that we started to see a reduction in the number of times we were failing lucky. So an increase in the number of times that we were failing safe.
That's right. And just to be clear with everybody, the total number of hypos or PSIPs over that period was about the same.
Mm.
But the fraction of incidents that occurred where we failed safely, our barriers were in place and worked, went up massively, 5 times what they were before. So imagine like a chart, right? And the you have two area lines. One is the incidents that fail safe, the other that fail lucky. The total, when you add the two together, was about the same. But imagine in your mind a massive increase of the number of incidents as a fraction of the total where you are failing safely.
So it's not that folks were going out to try to flood your system with examples of failing safely in order to water down the metric to make the percentage look better. It's that that you had the total amount was about the same, and the difference between the outcomes was the thing that was changing over time, not a massive increase of people just looking for something to make the metric look better. Am I reading between the lines as to what that means to you? Or
no, I think that's right. And that was an indication we're heading in the right direction. Are people gaming the metrics? I mean, humans are humans. So I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it was all perfect and rosy. I'm sure there was some gaming here and there. The question is, are we starting to see a difference in behaviors in the field? Mm-hmm. Which goes to your core question, right? Is how do we react when incidents occur? How are we strengthening the health of those barriers? And I would say that as a leader, I did two things. One is I asked all the operational leaders to know what their high consequence jobs are that occur most frequently. Let's start there. And to map out, think about a bow tie, the barriers that are in place to keep the worst from happening, and then essentially grade them. And what I asked them to do was, if I see they're all green, I'm going to get concerned.
Mm-hmm. Fear the green, yeah.
I don't want watermelons where it's green on the outside and red on the inside. That was the message. So as a leader, it was important for me to signal to people that not being at 100% was okay, because it's true. Things are never perfect. Yeah.
Yeah.
So if we don't have some areas where people that are putting together this work in conjunction with a central safety team, where they're finding areas of opportunity, for me, that's a warning signal as a leader. Mm-hmm. That's number one. Number two, when I was in incident reviews, I would constantly be asking for, to Ron's point, how is the system creating this outcome? And that question, that curiosity about the system, starts to shift the focus of the conversation from person X at the front line didn't follow procedure 200, and two, was the system set up to give that person at the front line a chance at success? And if the answer is the system was not setting them up for success, let's change the system. Okay? Yeah. And that mindset, that curiosity on the system came from some work that Fuzzy Bitar did from BP, right? He's their chief safety. I don't know what his exact title is. But he published something about 5-6 years ago where they looked at historically all of BP's significant incidents. And he found that I think the number was between 5 and 10% of those incidents were truly because of operator neglect on what they should be doing. The implication is that 90, 95% of it is because the system is set up to be too complex to give those operators a chance to be safe in their work. And whose job is it to monitor the health of the system? It's us, it's the leaders. So when an incident occurs, focusing the conversation on what can we do to remove complexity, to keep those engineering controls being the solutions versus the administrative, that all goes towards that mindset of let's create a system that allows operators every chance at success in their role, right? And let's also hold people accountable if there's neglect, intentional or not, in what they're doing to not follow, not comply with the system that's out there. It's a delicate conversation because there are humans involved. But that kind of directionally is a leader in those learning sessions and those incident reviews, really seeking to understand what did we learn about the health of the system, goes hand in hand with how we were trying to measure success in a lagging way in the field and measure success in a leading way in the field. And then in between, our operators and our safety people were working to try to find those opportunities to improve. And my ask was that they see them and that they make improvement.
So Eric, if I'm understanding this well, then a piece of why people responded the way they did, in terms of, hey, Eric's probably not going to be satisfied if we just tell him that our solution set here was to retrain folks to the same rule and process that we have always done, came one in your dissatisfaction with that as a solution set, but also in the types of questions you were asking, in which you were intentionally asking people to seek where the system or the process was driving the outcome that they were seeing, meaning that the default setting you had in place was that if we're going to bet on a system problem or a person problem, which we have both, which you just cited a study to show that we have both, if we're going to put our bet on which one we're probably dealing with, just percentage-wise, we're probably dealing with a system problem 90 to 95% of the time. So the questions that you're going to be most curious about that will drive other curiosity is, where is it? What are the systemic difficulties we're dealing with that are driving the outcome? Because our system is tuned to get the outcome it's getting right now. So help me understand why it looks the way it does. Help me understand why it makes sense for our people not to be following whatever exclusion zone it is. Help me understand why it looks that way, and not being satisfied with, well, it's because people don't care, Eric. That's why it looks that way, is because people just think it's a dumb rule and they don't care and none of our people care. I can't picture anyone actually saying that directly to you, but that would never be a satisfactory answer. Am I picturing that right, or did I just create my own narrative, put it in your mouth, and that's not what you meant?
Unfortunately, it's not so simple as black and white. Yeah.
Say more.
The answer sometimes is we do need to retrain people, because sometimes what we learn or what we need to learn as a group is that we need to up our game on training. Mm-hmm. That is for me an acceptable solution in some cases. And there's also a very clear lopsided likelihood that what we need to learn is more at the system level, at our controls that sit around the worker. So I'm not going to absolve every worker who has an incident from having a role in that. I don't think that's true 100% of the time.
Yeah.
However, I think as an industry, we tend to quickly focus on the errors or omissions or mistakes of the worker at the exclusion of spending as much or more time getting curious about how the system around them needs to improve.
And I think that messaging is really helpful for people to hear. There is a pretty large belief set, I would say, out of all the things that people struggle with in this subject, they struggle with the most is the feeling as though it's always a system problem. People never have any sort of accountability for their actions. Disciplinary action is not used anymore. Reinforcing of rules is not done anymore. That is the general feel that people get. If someone had that concern, which a lot of people do, are there more words you'd use to articulate your view? Because I would imagine if that's the way you viewed this subject, you would have never decided to go down this path. How would you help anyone see it from your perspective of, no, it's not black or white. That's not the way that this exists within an organization. Any thoughts there to allay people's fears or maybe describe it in a way that would make sense to them?
I think we need to have robust training for people. I think we need to have a culture of excellence and discipline in our execution. And I think we need to be really curious about how to make the systems that people are walking into every day when they leave their truck be as simple as possible to comply. For me, that is the focus. How do we get things as simple as possible to comply where we have the procedures as the key barrier? And how do we make sure that we have the proper engineering controls in place that can take the human out of the equation?
Yeah, I think that's a helpful perspective. Ron, from your seat, that balance, how does that live for you in terms of you're going out into the fields, you've got operations folks who are seeking your team's help in understanding things like barrier health. Can you describe any of the tensions you saw or tensions you didn't see of people struggling with, is it as simple as people just need to do what we told them to do and they're not? And that's why we're seeing that this barrier is not working. How does that look from your seat?
Yeah, it's from my perspective, and I think we're all aligned here. It's almost never that way. It's almost never that a worker is, you know, making a decision with the intention to get hurt or cause a spill or, you know, create some undesirable event. It's almost always, you know, the worker's intention to do good work. And so when that doesn't happen, or when we find deficiencies, you know, starting with curiosity, starting with trying to understand and get in the tunnel with those individuals to really, you know, although there may be frustration, you know, our reaction may be to experience some frustration, but to learn enough until we get to a point where we understand that, oh my goodness, it's not unexpected, you know, that someone would make that decision given the information that they had at the time. In fact, almost every instance where we've taken the time to really learn and understand why individuals do what they do, there's context present that once we understand it, help us understand it. Well, that's the same decision I probably would have made under those circumstances. But sometimes what gets communicated is, oh, the worker didn't follow the procedure. And all the context, you know, that goes with that is not well understood. You know, that we didn't do energy control. We didn't lock out an energy isolation point. We didn't follow the procedure. But, you know, underneath of it, well, the valve is tucked underneath the tank. There wasn't a valve handle that would make it clear what the orientation would have been. It's almost always closed. There was a lock and a tag on it that would indicate that it was closed. And so, you know, blaming workers isn't going to help us learn and improve. And I think fortunately, we're kind of in a place, I've been fortunate to work in organizations that understood we weren't going to discipline our way into safety excellence. But we certainly work with a lot of different employers in our contractor community, and we certainly come across an organization or two where when the mistake happens, you know, they find ways to discharge those individuals or to discipline them or to suspend them. And unfortunately, you know, there's not a lot to gain from that specific action is mm-hmm. what we're learning. Mm-hmm. That would
All
be
right.
my perspective.
All right. That's helpful, Ron. Matt.
I just really, Ron, you mentioned you were talking about like, well, a worker didn't follow a procedure. You're saying that's not what gets communicated. I think that's so profound and important, is so much of what happens after an event is what gets communicated after the event. And if we are taking the time to learn first and then communicating, I mean, that is profoundly different.
One of the phrases that I say probably too often is great leaders make great decisions when they have great information. And then when folks are not an individual who has influence over the C-suite or within the C-suite or influence over the board, and they ask, what can we do? Like, how do we make this change when we don't have that level of influence? I mean, the answer that I tend to give is, you give great leaders great information. That's what you do. You have to go seek it yourself. You might not have a structure that allows you to do that easily. You might not have a metric that pushes you to do that. But if you want a great leader to make a great decision, they have to have enough information to do that with. And if you bring a simplified story of, you know, operators don't understand the importance of this exclusion zone and that's why they're not doing it, well, then a great leader is going to make a decision based on the information that they've heard because they trust you to bring them accurate information. But if you instead bring them the story of, hey, in having this discussion, it seems as though it doesn't always make sense for us to have an exclusion zone as wide as what we have because of the types of loads we're picking up and the tonnage of the crane and the actual failure rates that would exist in this space, it actually feels a lot like overkill, which is why it's making it hard for people to either comply, or even when people do try to comply with creating that exclusion zone, it makes it really hard for others to do work around it because they physically have to be in it at the time that we're doing that work because it is so very large. When a great leader hears that information, suddenly the types of decisions that they make becomes different. And I think that that is this really fascinating two pieces of the puzzle, because it's hard to know if you're not getting great information. Meaning, as a leader, you can't be everywhere all at once, right? You can't be out in the field every minute of the day and understanding all of the contextual information that's going on. You have to rely on folks to bring you that information. And what they bring you is the place where you have to start making decisions. And so the fact that we have this team, the two of you, of the person, the Ron that is not only himself going out and learning directly from the folks and getting context, but teaching other people how to do it with a team around you, Ron, that is able to do that and has the skill set to go do that, then aligning with a metric that is part of a profound shift in belief in the way that we should be focusing our resourcing in order to make sure that people are able to not have a life-altering event. When you're able to put those two pieces together and then you have a great leader being given great information aligned with that thought process, the fact that your metrics show that shift is not a surprise to me, because those pieces all feel very much aligned together in a way that I don't think too many organizations have been able to recreate. It's pretty cool. Are we missing anything, Ron, from your perspective? Eric, from your perspective, what are we missing here?
Yeah, I think maybe just to come back to the beginning, which is to say that the reason why I was interested in doing this podcast with you, Andy and Matt, and with Ron, is not like trying to be boastful about, you know, some case study, but hopefully to inspire people to persevere and move the hearts and minds that need to be moved in order to get this kind of change going in their own companies. Because I do feel like the first 20 years I spent in the industry in the way I thought about safety and operations has been shaken to its core in the last five. And I wish I had heard a podcast like this so much earlier so that I could take action or influence others if I didn't have the authority myself. So I think it's important just to maybe put a fine point on this by saying that if people are looking for a way to get started, I think about myself as a CEO who maybe didn't come in with this game plan or didn't have this as a mindset, what would I do? I think it comes down to three things. One is having a really good case for action. And unfortunately, that case for action can come in the form of a company changing or life changing event that just had occurred, or exasperation of the board or senior leadership team about the current direction. Or it can come in the form of everything is going kind of okay in the company. Then what I would do is I would look for, show me anecdotes, examples, surveys, quotes that show me as a senior leader how the underlying system is brittle and that what's heading our way is kind of inevitable. If you can show me that what's happening in the field on a day-to-day basis is worrying, then it gets me curious. And that comes to number two, which is belief. You know, when I talked about making change at any enterprise, it comes down to leadership commitment and belief, whether it's going to the board or speaking in front of the organization, you know, bringing the principles of human performance in coupled with that strong case for action and getting the belief and some of the basics around, okay, if we're not perfect, what does it mean? Like really spending some time with the C-suite leaders to get to that point, I think would be number two. Because as I said before, once you're in that mind space, you're then hungry and thirsty for, oh crap, what do I do about this? And that's number three, which is to have a credible plan of what the steps would be to get there and how you would implement so that it's not disruptive for the organization, but that you can make tangible and measurable progress together over time, which will shift the system. So I guess I would just leave it there and say those three things I would advise anybody listening to this to really focus on: how can you be the start of the change?
Thank you, Eric. Ron, we missing anything?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, the best advice that I got along the way came from you, Andy, because I was trying to put our integration strategy together, and I had a pretty significant sized PowerPoint that I wanted you to review, and you reviewed it and you gave me some good advice, but on the side you said, what have you done so far? And I gave you a couple bullet points and you said, just keep doing that and it'll take you where you need to go, and that has held true for me since we had that conversation, and so I would just encourage anyone, you know, just get started and continue to sharpen your saw, continue to reflect on the five principles and how to embrace them and how to influence others to embrace them as well. And I think the result of that, it can be transformative. It is incredible. And I think that the results that you'll see are just as impressive. And I don't know about anyone else, but it's a better profession because of it. I feel so much better about the work that I do today because I'm not chasing TRIR any longer. And because I feel like I've got a lever to optimize the system and remove parts of the safety program that aren't delivering value like I didn't have before. So that would be my parting thought.
Thanks, Ron. And I don't think I know the right words to express how grateful I am to the both of you for your willingness to talk to this, and grateful that Eric, you just sent me an email and wanted a space to talk to it, because I would have never thought to ask. The reason why I'm so grateful is it is my I don't know if mission is the right word. I truthfully believe that this space of how we act in accordance to these concepts is beneficial, and not just in the safety realm. I think that there's so much benefit in many aspects of operations and in life. And it is a really hard thing to figure out how to do well. It is when it is a success in an organization, because our organizations are complex, it is a complex success, right? It's not just it feels linear in retrospect when we put it together, but there's so many elements that have to come together in the right place at the right time for it to work well, for a transformation to happen. And there was so much intentionality in what you all did, as well as elements of just, we're going to act in accordance with this, and we don't really exactly know what it's going to look like. Like, we have a plan, we have a direction, but it's not that everything's perfectly planned out. We're going to walk in this direction, and we're going to learn and adjust as we go. The fact that you all were willing to transparently talk to those pieces, I think, gives others something to hold on to. One of those pieces they can take, right, and insert it into their own complex organization and try to help navigate towards something better, knowing that nothing's ever perfect, but certainly we can always be moving towards something better than what we have now. So thank you. I appreciate the time, the energy, the transparency, the effort, the willingness.
This is the part where you all have said something very thought-provoking and kind. So it's my turn. And so, well, you all said it. So thanks, everyone, for listening. Eric, Ron, thanks for joining us for all these hours. And we look forward to everyone getting to hear it. And then, as always, there's ways to give us feedback of what you think. Yeah, thank you all for listening, and we'll talk again soon.
Well, that's it.
Yep, another one in the books. We did it.
If you want to send us any of your thoughts, actually fling us any of your thoughts, you can do so at the website www.hoppodcast.com.
That's hoppodcast.com.
It's still such a stupid name.
We look forward to hearing from you. Thanks for listening.